It is Monday, the 2nd of April, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks so much for joining us. Coming up, Palestinian protests turned violent in Gaza to continue through May 15th. China's loss of a spacecraft might not affect their space program.
Once they get this large space station, they also have a robotic lunar program. It's very probable that they'll put the two together and aim for a human flight to the moon.
And fusing Muslim tradition and Christian humor. It's all ahead on International Edition. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Israel's defense minister has rejected calls for an inquiry into the killing of 15 Palestinians by the Israeli military during a Palestinian demonstration that turned violent on Friday at the Gaza-Israel border. One report indicated 1,400 Palestinians were wounded in the incident, with about 750 of those wounded from live gunfire. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Middle East scholar Michael Fishbach of Randolph Macon College.
As an analyst who examines the Arab-Israeli conflict, I mean, I myself am tempted to say, well, exactly what kind of protest do you want Palestinians to do to express their grievances? Because it seems like shooting, and the Palestinian health authorities are saying that up to 800 were injured by gunfire. Now, I don't know if those are accurate, but certainly hundreds were injured beyond the 15 that were killed. And all of this is taking place on the Gaza side of the border, mind you. So it's a bit hard to understand exactly how Palestinians are expected to express their grievances toward Israel in a way that isn't either demonized or that doesn't lead them to be killed. I think the second point of significance is that it's showing that there is now a renewed effort by Palestinians to try to break the logjam, not diplomatically, because that has basically frozen the peace process, but that ordinary Palestinians are saying, notably in Gaza, but elsewhere too, that on this day of great significance, it goes back to 1976, the day of the land, we're going to express the fact that we are here and our grievances are still here, regardless of the peace process, the quartet, the Americans, the EU. And I think that, along with other symbols around the world, such as American students demanding safety from guns, it's an interesting portending of things that could come if real progress in terms of the peace process isn't made.
The Israeli military accused Hamas of, quote, cynically exploiting women and children by sending them to the fence area. A Hamas spokesman called the allegations, quote, lies aimed at justifying the massacres.
Well, it certainly is true that while Hamas is the governing authority, the de facto governing authority, this march was put together by a variety of different groups. And it's also, I think, a bit disingenuous for the government of Israel, which has been blockading Gaza, where there is an impending, by many indices, an impending humanitarian disaster that affects women and children. Your listeners should know that Gaza has one of the highest birth rates in the entire world. Probably half of Gaza is made up of people under the age of 20. So that when people speak about the suffering of women and children, I think Israel stands at the front of the line, along with Egypt, in making sure that that suffering goes on through the very intense blockade. So I find that a bit disingenuous, and I'm not sure a lot of people will give Israel's claims of Hamas endangering women and children much credence in light of that situation.
This protest is supposed to last weeks and culminate May 15th, when Palestinians mark the so-called Nakba, or catastrophe, when hundreds of thousands fled or were driven out of their homes back in 1948.
I imagine that's true. It will be the 70th anniversary of what Israel calls independence, what the Palestinians call the Nakba, or the disaster. And I do think that it symbolizes a renewed campaign among Palestinian civil society organizations and their allies globally to continue to raise the plight, notably of the refugees, but of the wider lack of resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. You know, much is made of the idea of a two-state solution, issues that the West Bank and Gaza, issues that arose after the 1967 war. But the heart of the dispute and the tragedy between Israel and the Palestinians goes back to 1948, to the refugee exodus, to the destruction of their villages, to the decision not to allow them to return, and so on and so forth. So I do think that the failure of the peace process to lead to anything is actually reigniting among Palestinian organizations and their supporters around the world, raising some of the key issues that predate 1967, that go beyond matters relating to a West Bank and Gaza state, refugees being key among them. And I think it was significant that it was all occurring on the Day of the Land, which is something that commemorates something that happened in 1976, not in the West Bank, not in Gaza, not in refugee camps in Lebanon, but among Palestinian citizens of Israel. And, you know, their fate, too, is something that goes back to 1948, and they wouldn't be affected by a West Bank and Palestinian state, and yet they feel they have grievances, too. So I can well imagine this lasting in the weeks to come, and but where that will ultimately result, what changes, if any, remains to be seen.
Well, does this become a possible new flashpoint in Israeli-Palestinian relations?
I think it could, because with the peace process frozen, with the Palestinian Authority and the government of Mahmoud Abbas in disrepute, Hamas has effectively not brought anything really tangible to the people of Gaza in particular. I can well imagine civil society organizations saying, you know, we're going to do things differently and we're going to do it in our way. And whatever else one thinks about that, certainly the first Intifada back in the late 1980s showed that when popular movements arise and they're not militant, I mean, in the sense that they're not using violence, and the leadership is dispersed and localized, it's very difficult for either Palestinian leaders and especially for Israeli leaders and Israeli military forces to know how to react. Because one thing that's been true throughout the Arab-Israeli conflict is the predictability of what the other side is going to do. And this is taking us in a new and unpredictable direction.
Michael Fishbach is a professor of history at Randolph-Macon College. He specializes in the history of the modern Middle East, especially that of Palestine, Israel, Jordan, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you live from Washington. I'm Doug Bernard. The Chinese Space Authority reports their Tiangong-1 spacecraft re-entered the Earth's atmosphere and largely burned up over the South Pacific Ocean today. Greg Kralacki is an expert on cross-cultural communication between the United States and China and is a China project manager for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He spoke with VOA from Nanjing about the Chinese losing control of the Tiangong-1, but says there's more to the China space program than this one event.
Well, China hasn't had any difficulties with, controlling its satellites or other spacecraft. So I don't think it's the fact that they've lost control of the re-entry of this module is a significant barometer you can use to judge the success or failure of China's space program. For example, just a couple days ago, they launched their 31st of their navigation satellites into orbit. China is building a very robust navigation satellite system to rival the U.S. GPS satellites, and they're almost done. So in very many areas, China's making significant progress in space. Human spaceflight, China's experienced some setbacks. The the technologies that they're using in these testing in these Tiangong modules, they've run into some problems that have delayed by a couple years the planned construction of their human space station.
Joan Johnson-Fries is a professor of national security at the U.S. Naval War College. We asked her about the state of the Chinese space program in comparison to the U.S. space program.
I characterize it as the very, very typical tortoise and the hare. What we did in a decade, they've been doing since 1992, but they're doing it in a way which they have very carefully planned out to have a sustained program, whereas the United States, we went to the moon, looked around, and even canceled some of our last missions. The Chinese have really studied that Apollo playbook and intend to pursue their space program towards incremental steps forward that once they get this large space station, they also have a robotic lunar program. It's very probable that they'll put the two together and aim for a human flight to the moon.
Tiangong 1, which means Heavenly Palace in English, was the largest man-made object to re-enter Earth's atmosphere in a decade. Before re-entry, it was the size of a school bus and weighed 8.5 tons. It was launched in 2011 and served as an orbiting laboratory for manned Chinese space missions until officials determined its lifespan was complete. It was taken out of service about 2 years ago. Over the weekend, Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai burst into tears and, according to a family friend, took deep breaths as she entered her childhood home in the Swat Valley of Pakistan for the first time since she was shot by the Taliban 6 years ago. Reuters' Gillian Kitchener reports.
It was uncertain whether Malala would even be able to visit the neighborhood due to security concerns. The roads were blocked off in the town as Malala, her parents, and her brother were flown in by a military helicopter. The visit reportedly lasted about 90 minutes. And according to Malala, who spoke at her hotel on Friday, the trip back to Pakistan was full of raw emotion.
I don't compare coming to Pakistan with anything. It has been the most beautiful day of my life. This has been the most important thing in my life. And I had never been so excited for anything. I had never been so happy before.
The Taliban claimed responsibility in 2012 for the attack on Malala when she was only 15 years old, for her outspoken advocacy for girls' education, which was forbidden under the militants' rule over Swat and their harsh interpretation of Islamic law.
Reuters' Gillian Kirchner reporting. All of that gave Malala more resolve. A new girls' school built with her Nobel Prize money has now opened in the region where the attack on her took place. Meanwhile, in Rome over the weekend, Pope Francis led an Easter service in which he baptized 8 adults, including a formerly undocumented Nigerian migrant beggar who became a hero when he disarmed an Italian thief wielding a cleaver.
Sono Francesco, vuoi ricevere il battesimo nella fede della Chiesa che tutti insieme abbiamo professato?
Sì, lo voglio.
Sono Francesco. Io ti battezzo nel nome del Padre, del Figlio e dello Spirito Santo.
Tens of thousands of faithful underwent heavy security checks to enter Vatican St. Peter's Square to participate in Easter Sunday Mass, led by the Pope. Dialogue and social discourse are among the most effective tools for promoting cultural understanding. So is humor. Now, that's the tool of choice for one white Christian comedian from South Carolina who claims an affinity for Muslims and a spicy Southern Asian dish called biryani. VOA's Diwa service correspondent Niala Mohammed took in one of his shows and files this report.
Awesome. That was awesome.
His name is Jeremy McClellan. He has been accused of being an extremist and a part of the Muslim Brotherhood.
I hope I'm going to heaven. That's my goal. Right. My goal is just to get in good with like each religion so that whichever one turns out to be true, I can sneak in.
But the Catholic comedian admits he's just a bit player in the Muslim cousinhood and an extremist only when it comes to biryani, his favorite food. McClellan uses sarcasm and comedy to create a bond of commonality between Christians and Muslims.
Well, I think there's so much that we have in common, you know, Christians and Muslims, and there's so many practices that we both have that we, you know, aren't necessarily aware of. Like with Lent, you know, Lent is a period of time. It's 40 days. You know, Ramadan is a month, and it's, you know, just a period of fasting and almsgiving and all these things that are, you know, the same in both traditions. But the rules are different. And so it's interesting to compare those two and see, like, okay, well, are we as strict as you? Like, who's fasting more? And it's sort of like healthy competition.
Besides a talent for making people laugh, Jeremy McClellan likes to foster an environment of mutual respect and understanding between the two religions. He says misunderstanding is generally to blame for much of the religious intolerance today.
You know, right now there seems to be this a lot of tension between Christians and Muslims. Not that there hasn't always some been in history, but and I think that, you know, now is a time when we can actually start to try and bridge those gaps and create dialogue and you know, talk about our differences, talk about what we have in common, and hopefully coexist.
The use of comedy to bridge the divide between faiths is not a new phenomenon. Imam Dalal Eid, a Muslim scholar, says interfaith humor goes back centuries.
Humor is important in our life. Even the Prophet Muhammad said that rawihu al-qulub sa'a ba'da sa'a, means entertain your hearts time after time. And he himself used to use his sense of humor when communicating with his companions. And he used this sense of humor to cement his relationship with non-Muslims. So American Muslims today, and Muslims in general, when they have interfaith relations, they have to do it with fun, not with too much seriousness.
McClellan is a part of a new generation of young comedians who use humor to serve as ambassadors of faith. And by combining those ancient methods of diplomacy with the well-timed joke, McClellan accomplishes what professional diplomats aspire to, resolving misunderstandings and creating friendly dialogue while making people laugh.
So one of the things I've learned is that the real schism within Islam is not between Sunni and Shia. It's about whether biryani should have potatoes in it.
Nyla Muhammad, VOA News, Washington, D.C.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA says, according to computer models, galaxies are created when dark matter clumps together. In other words, you usually can't find a galaxy without a good amount of dark matter. That is until a recent discovery that has been detailed in the journal Nature. A group of astronomers who used both ground-based telescopes and NASA's Hubble Space Telescope found an odd galaxy out there that they say has very little, if any, dark matter. According to the study, the galaxy called NGC 1052 DF2, which is as big as our Milky Way, only contains about 1/400th the amount of dark matter that was expected. The study's lead author, Peter Van Dokkum of Yale University, says the stars in the galaxy can account for all its mass. There doesn't seem to be any room for dark matter. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome back. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Finally today, many of us think of spying as something that happens at foreign embassies or exotic locations, but it may be happening much closer to home, perhaps right under your nose. As VOA's Tina Trin reports, spycraft is something that's happening at universities across the country, where espionage is often carried out under the guise of global education.
It's a typical scene at college campuses across the country. Students engaged in the pursuit of knowledge, hoping to one day make their mark on the world. It's not the first place you'd imagine finding government spies, but investigative reporter Dan Golden says you'd be surprised.
There's an awful lot more international students, international professors at American universities. Some of them are here to gather information for their countries.
Golden discusses various instances of espionage in academia in his book, Spy Schools. He says it's the free flow of ideas and cultural exchange fostered by universities that make college campuses so attractive.
There's a lot of research and development at major universities in the United States that a foreign government would look to exploit by sending students to study at these universities.
Americans studying abroad are often targets of foreign governments. In 2014, the FBI commissioned a film based on the real-life exploits of Glenn Shriver, an American student recruited to spy for China.
And then they're asked to go and apply for employment with the U.S. government or in a sensitive private sector area where we know those governments are targeting that type of specific information.
The United States is no stranger to intelligence gathering operations in academia. Alex Van Schaik was a Fulbright scholar researching labor movements in Bolivia when he met a U.S. government official.
He said, oh, and if you're out doing field work out in the countryside, if you run into any Cuban doctors or Venezuelan officials, we'd like you to report their whereabouts back to the U.S. Embassy.
But the FBI says that kind of recruitment is rare.
We do periodically enter in that type of agreement, but it's not as prevalent or nefarious as what you see from our students being exploited by the Chinese government or the Russian government.
Golden says raising awareness about the prevalence of espionage is key, citing a 2010 case of Russian sleeper agents who for years posed as ordinary Americans.
The vast majority of them were going to American colleges and universities or had gone to them. And that seemed to be something that Russia regarded as a crucial part of legitimizing a spy, you know, an American college degree.
Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
And thanks so much for joining us today for International Edition. Up next, the latest world news. Stay tuned for that. For all of us here in Washington, thanks for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Not so long ago, Venezuela, with its enormous oil reserves, was South America's most affluent nation. No more. When crude oil prices crashed, exacerbated by the government of Venezuela's mismanagement of the oil industry, so did Venezuela's economy. Today, Venezuela finds itself in an economic and political crisis that is steadily spiraling downward. Political repression, economic overdependence on a single commodity, mismanagement of the economy and the all-important oil sector, as well as crime, corruption, and political conflict all contributed to runaway inflation and a declining economy, resulting in shortages of everything from basic foodstuffs to medicines. According to the International Monetary Fund, Venezuela's inflation will rise to 13,000% this year, even as the economy will likely shrink by 15%. Venezuela's neighbors, particularly Colombia, are now coping with an enormous influx of people as Venezuelans leave their country by the thousands. That is why the United States has committed $2.5 million for emergency food and medical assistance to Venezuelans in Colombia and the Colombian communities who are hosting them, said Mark Green, administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. The influx of hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans has strained the medical and social services of Colombian border communities and others throughout the Western Hemisphere, said Administrator Green. Regrettably, this crisis in Venezuela, which is now spilling into the border region, is man-made, the result of continued political mismanagement and corruption by the Maduro regime. Unfortunately, even as people are suffering every day from hunger, lack of basic necessities, and preventable diseases, the Maduro regime continues to deny fundamental freedoms and access to basic humanitarian needs to the people of Venezuela. These delusional and inhumane policies by the Maduro regime have exacerbated an avoidable humanitarian crisis, he said. The United States will continue to support the people of Venezuela. We are proud to partner with Colombia, the Pan American Health Organization, and United Nations World Food Program to help relieve the suffering of people and communities affected by this deteriorating humanitarian situation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.